So the central banks were created in Europe in the 16th century. There's a very good reason for that. The kings and the princes of Europe discovered from hard experience that they could raise the taxes of their subjects only so far, and then there was a ceiling. They had a tax revolt on their hands. There was resistance, and they had real revolution or revolt on their hands, and they tended to lose their jobs or their heads. So that was it, folks. 40%, 43% seems to have been the natural limit. However, once they got the central bank mechanism worked out, this was a whole new ball game. Now the lid was off, and they were able to collect 50%, 60%, 70%, and in some cases, 80% of everything that their subjects produced. And their subjects did not revolt, did not resent it even, because they didn't know that they were paying this tax through a process called inflation. All they knew was that the prices were going out of sight, and they had no inkling that it was their government in combination with the private banks that were taxing them in this fashion. And so, see, this became a method of hidden taxation, which has continued to this day to be extremely popular with big spending governments. And so this became the modus operandi in Europe from that date forward. Now, when they met on Jekyll Island, it was very clear in their mind that they were creating a central bank. But they had a problem, what to call it, because Congress was already on record as saying they did not want a central bank in America. I don't think the congressmen really understood what that meant, but they had heard the phrase, and they knew that that's what they had in Europe. And they said, no, when it comes to banking reform in America, we want something that's unique to represent our unique political and economic system. So a central bank was out. So what to call this central bank so that no one will know? And they talked about this on Jekyll Island. And this is what they concluded. They said, first, let's use the word federal to make it seem like it's a government operation. Secondly, let's add the word reserve to make it seem like there are reserves somewhere, like it was a banking concept. Third, let's add the word system. And this was very important, far more than we might think today, because remember, the major concern was this concentration of financial power in New York. And they had to sell the American people on the idea that this was a diffusion of power over a system of banks. And so they talked about 10 regional banks, and finally they said, no, that's not enough. We'll have 12 regional banks and diffuse the power away from New York, or at least make it appear that way. And they'll build those big buildings in all these regions, and the local yokels can come and look at the buildings and say, golly, we got one of them out here too. And the impression was that because these buildings were out there, that the power was pulled away from New York and diffused throughout a system of Federal Reserve banks. Well, as you've heard said many times by now, what we wound up with was not federal. There are no reserves. It's not a system at all in the sense of diffusion of power. And the Federal Reserve banks aren't even banks. So on all four words, we're dealing with appearances of the fourth kind. Brilliant strategy. The next step was to sell this creature to the American people. And the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act was called the Aldrich Bill, sponsored by Senator Aldrich, of course. And this was against the good advice of Paul Warburg, who said, Nelson, if you put your name on this bill, it's going to get voted down in Congress because you are so closely identified with the power of big business. It'll be voted down. And apparently, Aldrich's ego was too big. He must have said, well, no, after all, I'm respected in the Senate, and I am the chairman of the National Monetary Commission. And for whatever reason, he insisted on having his name on it. I think he wanted to go down in history as the originator of the Federal Reserve System. But Warburg was right. Voted down. Thumbs down right away, because he was a representative of big business. Well, this was a minor setback. They took their bill. They scrambled the paragraphs around a little bit. They took Aldrich's name off of it and found a couple of Democrats to sponsor the bill. Now, this was different. See, Aldrich was a Republican, and everyone knew that the Republicans represented big business. But they also knew that the Democrats represented the common man, the little guy, the fellow on the assembly line, you know, like Ted Kennedy. So they found a couple of millionaire Democrats to sponsor the bill. They got Carter Glass from the House and Senator Robert Owen, who was a very successful banker. And now they sponsored the bill. It was the Glass-Owen bill, and this was different. This was a Democrat bill, and it began to receive very popular consideration in Congress. Next, Aldrich and Vanderlip began to give speeches and statements to the press condemning the bill that they had written. They said, this will ruin the banks. This would be terrible for the nation. And by the time this was printed in the newspapers, the average person read that and said, oh, I guess the big bankers don't like this bill very much. It must be pretty good. You know, you have to give these people credit. They were not stupid. They didn't get to be where they were through stupidity. They understood mass psychology, they understood politics, and they played their cards exceedingly well. Next, these same individuals who were condemning the bill were privately financing it. They were behind all the lobbying activities in Washington. They personally paid for the creation of what was called grassroots study clubs that came up all over the country, held public meetings, and disseminated brochures extolling the virtue of the Federal Reserve Act. They gave large amounts of money to some of the better-known universities and created new departments of economics, handpicked their own people to be the professors, to chair those departments, and then those men began to speak publicly and write scholarly essays about how wonderful the Federal Reserve System was. And then, at the insistence of Paul Warburg, who was always the master strategist in this, they added several good provisions to the act. When I say good, I mean provisions which restricted the power of the Federal Reserve System to create money out of nothing. The kind of provisions you and I might have endorsed. And Warburg's associates said, Paul, what are you doing? We don't want those things in there. This is our bill. And his response was classic. He said, relax, fellows, don't you get it? Our object here is to get the bill passed. We can fix it up later. That's exactly what he said. When no one is looking, everyone is focusing on the bill now. Let's get it in. Fix it up later, and indeed he was right. It was because of provisions such as those that they won over the support of William Jennings Bryan, who was the leader of the populist movement, a real defender of the common man, in his mind at least. He looked at that bill, and previously he had opposed it because he said it was the bill of the bankers. They would create money out of nothing, he said. And he looked at those provisions and he said, oh, well, I guess with those in there, I can support the bill. And with the elimination of his opposition, the road was cleared, and it was inevitable what would happen. They did fix it up later. Since the Federal Reserve Act was passed, it has been amended over 100 times, and nobody has noticed. All of those original provisions, which were sound, were long ago removed, and many, many more have been added, which greatly expand the power and reach of the Federal Reserve System. A big bunch was added back in 1980. It just extends the power of the federal government to areas that you can't even imagine. We're talking previously about being able to create money out of government debt, American government debt. They can now create it out of foreign debt. Any country in the world. Any country in the world can offer a bond, an IOU, and our Federal Reserve System is now empowered by law to convert that into American money. even corporate debt. They can convert that into American money. There's no limit whatsoever. And nobody has noticed. So Warburg was right. They fixed it up later. And it's no surprise, therefore, that with this kind of professional deception and strategy, that a great deal of support was gained for the bill. And on December 22, 1913, it was passed into law and signed into law the next day by President Wilson. And the creature from Jekyll Island finally moved into Washington, D.C. Well, what did we get? Let's stand back from the creature now a few paces and survey its general form. We got a corporation chartered by Congress, which was given an exclusive franchise to create the nation's money. We got a mechanism whereby Congress has been able to raise unlimited amounts of taxes through inflation without the American people even knowing that they're paying the tax. And we got a mechanism whereby the banks can earn perpetual interest on nothing. I'd like to turn our attention now to an intriguing question, which is, who owns the Federal Reserve System? You often hear this topic discussed on talk radio. Whenever the subject of money or the Federal Reserve comes up, inevitably somebody will get on the telephone and say, did you know that the Federal Reserve System is not a government agency at all? It's a private corporation. It's run by the private banks. And what we need to do, they'll say, is to abolish the Fed and turn it over to Congress, so it can be run for the benefit of the people. Well, I'd like to deal with that because this involves a half-truth and a non-solution. Let's start with a half-truth first. It is true that the Federal Reserve System is not an agency of the federal government. As I mentioned before, it is a corporation chartered by Congress. And like all corporations, it has stock certificates. And these certificates are held, in this case, by the member banks within the system. All the banks, remember this is a cartel, independently owned banks make up this system. They hold the stock certificates. All right. Now, up to that point, it looks as though this has all the attributes of a privately held corporation. But that's as far as it goes. Because these stock certificates do not carry with them any of the powers of private ownership. For example, the holders of these stock certificates cannot sell them. Well, if you can't sell something, you don't really own it. Because that's one of the tests of ownership, is your freedom to dispose of it in any way you wish. Also, the larger banks have put up more capital into the system than the smaller banks. It's not a lot of money, but it's related to their assets. The larger banks put up more, have more stock certificates than the smaller banks. And yet, regardless of that, all of the banks have one vote. So there's another violation of the principle of private ownership. Furthermore, that vote doesn't buy anything of substance. These banks cannot vote for their national management. The Federal Reserve System is run by the Board of Directors of the Federal Reserve System, the National Board, and its chairman, all of whom are appointed by the President. The stock certificate holders have no voice in that whatsoever. The only thing they can vote for are the members of the board of their local regional banks, so-called banks. But guess what? The chairman and the vice chairman of those regional banks are appointed by the national board. Guess what? They can vote for their officers of the regional banks, but they can be overridden. The national board has veto power over those people. You get the picture here? In spite of this sales job, of this diffusion of power over the 12 regional banks, these banks have no power at all. It's all concentrated in the national board. The only thing that the regional banks can do, according to their charters, of any substance, is to set the interest rates within their regions. But guess what? Even that is subject to veto by the national board. So you come to the conclusion that these people at the national board are not authorized to do anything except play golf. See, that's the way it was designed. This fiction of this diffusion of power throughout the system was just to sell it to the American people in 1913. It's a vestige. It serves no function whatsoever today at all and was never designed to. So we don't have a corporation in the strict sense of the word, a privately held corporation. And we don't have a government agency in the strict sense of the word. So what do we have? Well, the fact is we have hybrid. It's a mixture. It's half government and it's half private. It is, in fact, exactly what you would expect it to be, considering that it is a partnership between the government and a private cartel. It's half government and it's half private. So this structure is unique to reflect its unique form. But this isn't so important as to who owns it, how many shares of stock, and what the voting is. The question is, what does it do? Insofar as merely abolishing the Fed, as many people have said, abolish the Fed and turn it over to the Treasury or turn it over to the Congress so it can be run for the benefit of the people. Always make sure you say it's for the people, and that makes it okay. It would do the same thing over there that it does over here. It's not a question of who owns it, it's what does it do, and as long as it is a central bank, which means as long as it has the power and the mandate to create money out of nothing, that's what it's going to do. It's going to create money out of nothing, and I'm sure the same people will run it over there that run it over here. We must remember that all of the central banks of Europe are in fact direct agencies of their respective governments. They are not these hybrid organizations over there that they are here, because there was no necessity to create that myth over there. They just went right for it. It's an agency of the government over there. And they all do exactly the same thing as our Federal Reserve System does here. So you see, just turning it over to Congress without taking away its power to create money out of nothing is a non-solution. And I'm sure that the people who run this would be willing to use the same kind of deception they did back when it was created. They would pretend to resist that idea. They would fight it with all of their might, at least in public, knowing that they could yield on that and have it turned over to the Congress and they'd still have control of it, over it. So that is a non-solution. I'd like to talk now about what the objectives of the Federal Reserve System are, because if we're going to say it's going to, if it were turned over to Congress, it would pursue the same agenda. What is that agenda? Extremely important thing to focus on, because we're told that the purpose of the Fed is to stabilize the economy. And everybody kind of believes that. I mean, when Greenspan comes on and says, well, we're raising interest rates now, why? To stabilize the economy, right? To prevent inflation. In other words, to protect you folks. To protect you. And we buy it. Well, one of the most widely used textbooks in our schools right now, textbook on economics written by Paul Samuelson, explains it this way. It says, quote, "The Federal Reserve sprang from the panic of 1907 with its alarming epidemic of bank failures. The country was fed up once and for all with the anarchy of unstable private banking." It's partly true. It's just they came up with the wrong solution. Just because there's a problem doesn't mean that any old solution that somebody has to offer is the best. In fact, it may be a non-solution. As we were talking about, just turning this system over to the government to run is a non-solution. Well, let's take a look at this. If the purpose of the Federal Reserve System is to stabilize the economy, let's give it a report card and see how well it's done.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
It's time for you to have your own custom smartphone app for your business and pay way less than you can imagine. Introducing the I Can Get To Silent Salesman mobile marketing app, a global mobile marketing and communication tool for your business. Go to appsapart.com and learn how you could earn up to $36,351 or more per month just by inviting two people or less into a $14.95 per month program. Go to appsapart.com and be sure to watch the video at the top of the site and listen to the audio message from the CEO near the bottom. This is something you won't want to miss. Go to appsapart.com now or call 646-860-9540. That's 646-860-9540. Get the I Can Get To. That's ICANGET, the number 2, Silent Salesman app at appsapart.com. That's appsapart.com.
Since it was formed, it has presided over the crashes of 1921 and 1929, the Great Depression of 29 through 39, recessions in the years 53, 57, 69, 75, and 81, a stock market Black Monday in 87. We all know that corporate debt is soaring, personal debt is greater than ever before. Both business and personal bankruptcies are at an all-time high. Banks and savings and loan associations have failed at a rate greater than ever before in our history. Interest on the national debt is now consuming half of all of our taxes. Heavy industry has been largely replaced by overseas competition. We're facing an international trade deficit for the first time in our history. 75% of downtown Los Angeles and other large metropolitan areas are now owned by foreigners, and over half of the nation right now is officially in a state of recession. Now, that is the report card of the Federal Reserve System after 80 years of stabilizing the economy. And I don't think it's even controversial to say that the Federal Reserve has failed to meet its stated objectives. The only controversial question is, why has it failed? And my answer to that is because those have never been its true objectives at all. What are its true objectives? Well, what are the objectives of any cartel? To make money. to enhance the profit margins of the members of the cartel and to stabilize its position in the marketplace, to prevent competition. Those are the objectives of any cartel. And if our analysis is correct here, we'll find that this, in fact, has been what the Federal Reserve System has accomplished for itself and its component members. To be more specific, it's possible to go to the period of Jekyll Island and read the papers and speeches that were done by the people on Jekyll Island and their associates. The big banks were concerned over three things, among other things, but the three main things were as follows. They said they wanted to reverse the erosion of their power away from New York. That's right, just the opposite of what the Federal Reserve System was supposed to accomplish. They wanted to keep it in New York. They were concerned because as the nation was spreading westward and southward, new banks were springing up all over the frontier, and more of the capital assets of the nation were moving in that direction. Yes, they still had the lion's share, but every year the percentages went down a little bit, and they could see where that chart was going. And they said, we must put a stop to this now while we still have power. Remember, John D. Rockefeller said it, competition is a sin. And competition from the new banks in America was something that had to be stopped. See, one of the purposes of the Federal Reserve System was to control the competition from the new banks. And this is a good place to emphasize that when I'm talking about the cartel, I'm primarily talking about the big banks in New York that created it, and the international banks as well, the ones in Europe. I'm not talking about your bank down the street that ever since the system was created has struggled and struggled under the regulations of the system, which were designed primarily, to some extent, to squeeze the competition out or to keep it in its place. And you've seen that process going on throughout the years. We have fewer and fewer banks all the time, little ones getting gobbled up by the big banks. So that was objective number one. Number two, they wanted to reverse the trend of what is called private capital formation. Now, what that means is simply this. It means that people in those days were using their own savings instead of going to the bank and borrowing. Corporations in particular found that it was better for them to withhold some of the dividends from their stockholders each quarter, put that money into a sinking fund, let it accumulate, or let the capital form, as they say, capital formation, and then use their own money to build the new factory or launch a research and development project or whatever, instead of going to the banks. And the banks were extremely concerned over this trend. They racked their brains. How do we get businesses to come back to the banks and borrow money again? And their answer was quite simple. If you were a banker, you would know how to do that. The answer is to lower interest rates, to make those rates so attractive that you'd be crazy not to go to the bank and borrow the money at those interest rates. It's so much easier than saving. Well, why didn't they just lower interest rates? Because that was 1913, ladies and gentlemen, and they couldn't. Money was real money in those days. It was backed by gold and silver. There was no lever on it. No man, no group of men, no politicians, no bankers could arbitrarily affect interest rates. Because it was backed by gold and silver, the money was, and they couldn't just create it out of nothing. You see, under those conditions, interest rates are the product of the forces of supply and demand in a free market economy. Nobody has control over it. And that's why the politicians hate money that's backed by gold and silver. They cannot manipulate it. So their challenge was, how can we artificially depress the interest rates below the natural level that's produced in the free market? And the solution was, they said, the nation needed what was called a flexible currency. They said, this is what industry needed to prosper, a flexible currency. You still hear that phrase today, the virtues of a flexible currency. Well, what is a flexible currency? You need a dictionary. Well, it's not paper money that folds. What that means is money created out of nothing. That's what a flexible currency is. See, the trick is not particularly hard to figure out here. If you are creating money out of nothing, you don't have to charge an awful lot of interest on it to show a profit. See, it's as simple as that. So, with a flexible currency, now they have a lever on it. And they can jack the interest rates down, 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 so that it's attractive, and they're still making plenty of profit on it because it didn't cost them anything. And they have reversed the trend toward private capital formation. And the third objective that they spoke about in those days was how to pass on the inevitable losses within the banking system, to pass those losses on to the taxpayer in the name of protecting the people. Now, let's give the Federal Reserve System another report card with these objectives in mind and see how well it has done. Did they keep control over the banking system and the monetary system in New York? And yes, they did. Anyone who knows how the markets function, it has always remained in New York. In fact, it's even more so now in New York than it was then. Yes, there are plenty of large banks in the nation, in the South and in the West, but these are small compared to those giants that are in New York, in fact, that are astride the world, with offices in Peking and Moscow and Africa, everywhere in the world. The giants are in New York, and they have been running the show all of these years. A few years ago, there was a book that appeared on the market called Secrets of the Temple, written by William Grider and published by Simon & Schuster. It was a bestseller, and it was advertised as a scathing attack against the Federal Reserve System. Well, when I heard that, I could hardly believe my eyes and my ears. A scathing attack against the Federal Reserve System? Published by Simon & Schuster? Now, this is one of the biggies. I thought to myself, well, a miracle has happened. I guess I don't have to finish my book because it's done. Somebody did it. So I ran down and I got a copy of the book and I went through it and I was amazed at what I found on two points. First of all, I was amazed because Grider had his history very well done indeed. It was accurate. I didn't expect that. I thought it might be a whitewash of some kind. But it wasn't. It was very good. I knew about this because I was right then in the process of researching it, and Grider had it. And on this point of the concentration of power in New York, I'd like to read to you just a couple of sentences from his best-selling book. He's talking about 1913 here, and he said, at the time, the conventional wisdom in Congress was that the government institution would finally harness the money trust, disarm its powers, and establish broad democratic control over money and credit. The results were nearly the opposite. The money reforms enacted in 1913, in fact, helped to preserve the status quo, to stabilize the old order. Money center bankers would not only gain dominance over the new central bank, but would also enjoy new insulation against instability and their own decline. Once the Fed was in operation, the steady diffusion of financial power halted. Wall Street maintained its dominant position and even enhanced it. Which is true. Now, the second thing that amazed me about his book was his conclusion. After demonstrating that the Federal Reserve System had always acted against the public interest and that it was designed to do that from the beginning, what do you suppose his conclusion was regarding what we should do about it? Abolish the Fed? No, no, nothing that extreme. Well, how about a major overhaul? No, no, not necessary. He said, you see, folks, it's all so complicated. But we're learning as we go, and we're getting better at it. Relax, everything's under control. All we need now are wiser men. Well, there you have an interesting situation. You see, that's the kind of powder puff solution that it takes to be published by Simon & Schuster, or any of the other major publishing houses which are firmly locked into the financial web of the money trust in Wall Street. There's no way in the world that these major media outlets are going to allow anybody to come up with a real solution to the problem. I need to digress here just for a second because we have a lot to learn from this, not just in the field of the Federal Reserve System, but in many other areas of concern to our nation in these critical days ahead. It's not enough just to point with alarm. It's not enough just to say, well, this is historically true, and it's not enough to lead the charge if you don't lead it anywhere. See, these people don't care how much you expose their scams or their conspiracies or their plots if you have no solution. If your only solution is, well, now I told you about it, for now just vote Republican. You know? If that's it, nothing's going to happen, is it? Till we look behind party labels. In other words, wiser men, whatever that means. This is controlled opposition, ladies and gentlemen, and it's something that's been going on for a long time. These people are smart enough. Remember, they sold this Federal Reserve System in the face of opposition, and they did it by deception. They're smart enough to control their own opposition or to create their own opposition if necessary so they can lead it nowhere. I'll just leave that thought with you because it's something we need to be very aware of in the critical days ahead. Let's get back to the Federal Reserve. It gets an A on its report card for objective number one, which is to maintain control over the money markets in New York. Did they reverse the trend toward private capital formation? Boy, did they ever. With interest rates brought down periodically to such attractive levels, individuals and corporations have been enticed away from saving their own money and going to the bank. You'd be a fool not to get that money at those low interest rates. Of course, then the economy contracts and things go a little sour now and then, and the fruit falls from the tree and they pick it up. They get all your marbles, they get all your assets, your houses, your cars, your factories, your stocks, and your bonds. That's one of the reasons we've had so many bankruptcies in the decades past. Even those companies today which are hanging in there by the skin of their teeth because it's all they can do to make payments to service their debt to the banks. Notice that many of those companies are now sending more money to the banks as interest on their loans than they send to their stockholders as dividends on their stocks. Think about that. The banks, which created the money out of nothing, no effort at all, no risk really of anything, are making more money out of these giant industries than the people who worked for the money, sacrificed, saved the money, invested it, and risked it. And yet the money is going to the banks. Yes, the Federal Reserve System, in fact, gets an A on its report card for reversing the trend toward private capital formation, and they did it with a flexible currency, just as they had planned to do it. And what about the third objective, which was to pass the losses on to the taxpayers in the name of protecting the people? That is something which I call in my book Operation Bailout, the game called Bailout. You may have noticed every time a large bank gets into trouble, not the small banks, they're dispensable. The large banks, when they get into trouble, they're going to be bailed out by the government, which means by your tax dollars and mine, in the name of protecting the people. It doesn't make any difference if it's a private corporation or a city, municipality, or a third world country. Whoever has borrowed megabucks from these banks and now can't service their debt anymore, they have trouble making those interest payments, which is all banks care about. They don't want you to pay back the loan, because they'd have then just the problem of finding somebody else to lend it to. They don't want you to pay back your loan. They want you to pay the interest on the loan and keep those loans going forever. And finally, when people have trouble making those interest payments and it looks like the bank is going to have to write it off of its books, what happens? They go to Congress and they say, well, this corporation that's having trouble making its interest payments, we can't let that corporation fold, because look how many thousands of jobs would be lost and people would go on welfare. There would be despair. We must protect the people. Or if it's a third world country, that can't make its interest payments anymore. They said, well, we can't allow that to happen. We must make those payments for them in some way or another. Because if that venerable bank had to write that huge loan off of its books, it would technically be bankrupt. And if it were bankrupt, it might have to close its doors. If that bank were to fall, it's such a huge bank, it'd be like a domino, and it might knock the other banks down too. And we could have a major economic crisis on our hands, and look how the people would suffer. And so Congress dutifully always responds. Remember, Congress is the partner in this scam. Always rushes in and says, yes, we can't allow those bad things to happen to the people. And so they vote the money to guarantee the loans or make outright payments in some very creative fashions so that the interest can continue flowing to the banks. Some of the more memorable games you may have missed over the recent years: Penn Central Railroad was bailed out in 1970, Lockheed Corporation that same year, Commonwealth Bank of Detroit in 1972, New York City in 1975, Chrysler in 1978, First Pennsylvania Bank in 1980, Continental Illinois, the largest of the banks so far, in 1982, and of course we know how many third world countries out there have had their debts funded. The money comes from the IMF World Bank so they can continue making their payments. And the IMF World Bank gets their money from the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve System gets it from us in the form of that Mandrake mechanism and the hidden tax called inflation, or direct taxes in some cases. The Federal Reserve System gets an A on its report card on all three of its true objectives. My final topic is a short one, and it has to do with usury. An interesting concept. Usury used to be defined in ancient times as interest on a loan, period. Any interest on any loan was usury. Well, it's been redefined in modern times as excessive interest on a loan, in view of the fact that when people earn their money and they save it, they sacrifice the use of it, and then they loan it to somebody else for their venture, they're entitled to some reasonable return on that sacrifice. Some interest return it seems fair and logical to most people. So the question today is excessive interest. What is that? It was Thomas Edison who said, "People who will not turn a shovel full of dirt on the project, nor contribute a pound of materials, will collect more money than will the people who will supply all the materials and do all the work." When I read that, I wondered if that was true. I took my calculator and I ran the numbers. You might try this sometime. If you assume a $100,000 home to be built, and that $30,000 is to go for the land and the architect's fees and the building permits, that kind of thing, $70,000 to go for the actual construction of the house, the materials and the labor. You assume further that the buyer goes to the bank, puts 20% down, takes out a 10% loan for 30 years. Punch in the numbers, and you will see that he will pay to the bank in interest $172,741 compared to $70,000 for labor and materials. In other words, as Edison said, 2.5 times more will be paid to the banks who did nothing than for those who provided all the labor and all the materials. And you may say, well, yeah, that's true, but don't forget the time value of money. Reasonable interest is rational. People need to be compensated for the sacrifice of their money over 30 years. That's a long period of time. Wait a minute. Not this money, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody earned this money. Nobody saved this money. Nobody sacrificed anything for this money. This money was created out of nothing. And I suggest that $172,741 interest on nothing is excessive. I think we need to focus on this issue. We need a new definition of the word usury. Any interest on any loan of fiat money, meaning money created out of nothing. Now, this example of $172,741 unearned interest on a $100,000 home is like a grain of sand in the Sahara. Look around the desert. All of the other homes of America, all the factories, all the machinery in the factories, all of the high-rise buildings, the hotels, all the airplanes, the automobiles, the farm equipment, the farm structures, everything that we have, we're looking at a similar relationship here. This is staggering. To consider the amount of money that is in this huge, wide river of wealth flowing into the banking cartel because the money was created out of nothing. It's such a wide river of wealth, you can't even think across it in your mind. It's perpetually moving into the banking cartel. This is a dead short across the productive capacity of America. This is money that should be going to the people who produce and who create instead of being siphoned off through a scam. Think of what our standard of living could be if it weren't for this dead short across our economy. Well, where is this money going? This river, where is it flowing? You get the mental picture that maybe it's going into a lake somewhere or behind a dam. All this money is rising, accumulating. People are getting richer and richer and richer. No, not so. It's not how it works. They're spending the money. What are they spending it for? Well, they're not spending it for more yachts and more mansions. That's not it. I mean, they got rid of the mansions back on Jekyll Island. They got bored with those things. Once a person has all the money that they can possibly use for the material pleasures of life, what is left? Sure, power. Absolutely. They are spending this money for power, ladies and gentlemen, to acquire power over you and me and our children. They're literally buying up the world with it, but I don't mean they're buying up the real estate or the hardware. They're buying up control over people. Technically, in sociological terms, they're buying control over the power centers, which means those groups and institutions through which people live and work and follow leadership and accept information. People are always associated in groups, and they work in groups, they move in groups. And these groups have heads of them, leaders. And this money has been going for many years to acquire influence, if not control, over the leaders of these power centers in society. So they can, therefore, indirectly influence and control you and me. Specifically, that means they have been spending this river of wealth very freely to buy control over politicians, political parties, television networks, cable networks, newspapers, magazines, publishers, wire services, motion picture studios, universities, labor unions, church organizations, trade associations, labor unions, tax-exempt foundations, multinational corporations, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, you name it. Make your own list. I guarantee you, if you have a large, influential organization which influences people, you will find that this river of wealth has been flowing partly into an attempt to acquire control over the leadership of these institutions and organizations, especially those which are offered as opposition, especially those which supposedly are to stop this whole process from happening. Now, this has not only been going on in America, but this has been going on in every nation of the world, pretty much in the industrialized nations as it has gone on here. But I'd like to call your attention to what's been happening in the so-called third world or the underdeveloped nations. This process is now complete. It's not going on. It's finished. They literally have bought those nations. Have you ever wondered what's going on there with the IMF World Bank? Every once in a while on the back page of the newspaper, you read that Congress once again authorized another $100 billion or so to go to the World Bank. And then it explains very carefully that this money is being used for humanitarian reasons. It's being used to uplift the standard of living of these poor people. That is an appearance of the fourth kind if you ever saw one. It's not being used for that at all. If it is, they're not doing a very good job, because after all these years, you cannot point to one of those countries which has had its standard of living raised one iota by this vast expenditure of money, because it was never designed to do that. The money does not go to the people. It does not go to the industries or the businesses of those countries where it might have a chance of raising the standard of living. It goes to the politicians, doesn't it?
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
And it goes to the governments of those countries, and it is used specifically to perfect and strengthen the control mechanisms over their people. Usually this starts out as an inefficient dictatorship, but by the time they get the UN money, it ends up as an efficient dictatorship. They have a better organized and equipped army. They have a better paid bureaucracy, more people in the bureaucracy. They have more ways of controlling their subjects. They have food chains that they can offer to their friends and deny it to their enemies. This money is used to build totalitarian systems in every country that you want to point to and analyze. You see, these people, these leaders of these countries, for the most part, couldn't care less about the standard of living of their subjects. As long as they live well, they live in their mansions, have their yachts, their jet aircraft, and they go to New York and live in the Waldorf Astoria while they attend United Nations meetings. They're very happy with that. They have no ideology. Communism, socialism, fascism, capitalism, what difference does it make? Where's the money? That's it with these people. We know how welfare families in this country can be second, third generation families, and there's no hope at all of getting them off the dole because they can't imagine any other way of life. This happens at the international stage too. We're dealing with countries now that are second, third, in some cases fourth generation welfare governments. They don't know how to survive unless that money comes free through the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, means from us. There's no way in the world they're going to break free from that. These countries, ladies and gentlemen, have already been purchased, lock, stock, and barrel, in this fashion, and they are now in place in the New World Order. And they're simply waiting for us to show up. And that's the other side of the coin, because not only does this transfer of wealth to these countries from us not raise their standard of living, but it does, in fact, help to lower ours. And this, too, is part of the plan. A strong nation is not a candidate for surrendering its sovereignty. But if a nation can be brought to its knees, if it is hungry, desperate, if it has chaos on its street, in its streets, if it has political turmoil, then the people in that nation will much more likely accept any solution that's offered to them by their government or by a world government. If there's anarchy in the streets, as we saw in Watts, in Los Angeles, people were joyous when the soldiers showed up. They were joyous because this now was an end to anarchy. It was a dress rehearsal. They won't care whether the helmets on these people are blue or brown. If it says UN on the side, that won't make any difference. They'll say, thank God for the UN finally brought and restored peace to our streets. And if people are hungry and they're out of work and they don't know what to do in the economy, they'll be so thankful for a UN monetary unit which has purchasing power a little bit. Thank God for this UN money, because the old American dollars are kaput. Don't know what to do with it. This is the plan, ladies and gentlemen, to weaken America. And so that's the process. And I'm mentioning this because I want to emphasize to you that what is going on here has nothing at all to do with wealth. The name of the game now is power. Well, now, what are we going to do about this? Obviously, if we just restrict our attention to the subject which is ours tonight, the Federal Reserve System, the answer is clear. We have to slay the creature. But how are we going to do that? The creature was created by Congress, and that's how it's going to be slain. Congress can do it and will do it if we build enough fire under those chairs in Washington. I think it was Clyde Watts, General Clyde Watts, years ago, said, he was speaking of judges in those days, but he could have as well talked about congressmen. He said, they may not see the light, but they can feel the heat. And this is true. I don't know if you folks know, well, I know many of you folks here know all about the TRIM committees, which are part of the John Birch Society. They have proven themselves to be excellent ways of getting some of these big spenders out of Congress. It just happened. We saw, what I think it was 30 of them replaced, not entirely because of TRIM activity, but believe me, it had a lot to do with it. This is something that works. And even those that didn't come up, that didn't get replaced, they're having their voting records changed. I don't have the name here, unfortunately, but I heard just the other day there was some congressman. We had the letters shown to us there. Here was a guy with his voting record. It was very bad. He was voting for big government and higher taxes. And the TRIM committee started to hand out his TRIM bulletins in his district, and it was at a gun show. And he came over and says, take those things off the table. And he was irate. He said, well, we can't do that, Congressman. That's your report card, you know. And he wrote a real nasty letter or two, and they had copies of it. And he said, you know, I think that these TRIM bulletins are good for one thing, and that's to line the bottom of the birdcage. That's what he said. The next election, his report card was all good. He decided, I can't get rid of these TRIM bulletins. He's changed his voting, and the next report card was good. He straightened out. He had no particular principles, but these fellows put their finger to the wind, and they can tell which way it's blowing. And if he wanted to be reelected, he had to get into step. And I know that a lot of these people go around saying, well, I've been trying to warn my constituents of this danger for many years, once the fire is built under their seats. So that is a very important program, and we can do it simply by exposing the voting records of these people and not just taking their words. Now, all of this, of course, this whole program requires an informed electorate, and that doesn't just happen. You don't inform the electorate just by wanting it to happen. You have to have quality educational materials.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. care. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT-TODAY.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.